Let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love. We thank you for breaking into history and displaying that love in brilliant, incandescent visions of your Son. The humility, the moral integrity, the compassion, the fellowship, the reaching out that he did to us. What a revelation of who you're like, what your heart is like. We ask that we, as we look in this stuff today about redemption and these big words, we would get a glimpse again of what you're all about, what your delight is, what things you wish for us, things that you strive to produce in our lives, the relationship that you want us to have with you. And we ask that it would be clear to us, that we would get a little more clarity about the beauty of your love and the aggressiveness of your kindness toward us. We ask this for your Son's sake. Amen. Okay, we are in, we're on our syllabus on redemption. And redemption is one of those religious words. And that's what we're trying to explain in terms of history, where we're coming from and what do those words mean. We have started this process a couple of years ago, it seems like. And what we were trying to do was look at the event of the cross, you know, a couple thousand years ago, and try to understand why God did it that way. Why did our situation require something so drastic as that? The views of God and deity prevalent at the time, you know, would not have said that they would die as an executioner, you know, as in execution. You would not have expected that the night before he died, this incarnate God, the ruler that was going to become Lord of all, that this person would set aside their normal clothes, take on the clothes of the lowest house servant, and wash the feet of the disciples to show them what he was really like. See, this would not make sense in the ancient world. God wasn't like that to most of us. God was distant. God was judge. God was cold, perhaps. He, as we saw this morning, our first thought was to try to buy that God off with ritual and pretense and try to barter with God. And somehow our arrogance required us to pay something as opposed to the humility that comes with accepting a free gift. I'm so aware of that we sometimes in normal human endeavors, we will resist and reject favors from someone else so that we won't be in debt, even mild and unstated debt to another. There's that we just don't experience free gifts. Really, really free gifts that often in human experience. And so when we look at the cross and it's just so bizarre compared to what we would perhaps expect, and it's at some level incomprehensible. You just don't, you know, why did we have to go that far? Why did God have to do it that way? wouldn't that overkill? And it basically points out that we are at some level unaware about the seriousness of our situation. You know, we float along very often in denial. I mean, we live lives of denial, you know, as a carefully calculated habit. We put off big issues. We deal with things. We've constantly confronted with this in our lives. And so when something that monumental occurs and God said, this is what it took, the more reasonable of us back up and say, oh, I didn't think it was that bad. Tell me more. What was going on? And that's what we've been trying to understand, is that when God said, I did this, now I want to explain to you How can we have static if my mic isn't working? I'm just thinking, you know, so what's wrong with this picture?
I knew I was bad, but not that bad.
How can I generate? This is the entropy, really, to an extreme, right? What we've been trying to do is look at how God explains that. So we've got this event, and it is the foundation of the religious tradition that we find ourselves in this morning. We woke up this morning. We're in this history. We're membered inside this path of history. And God has explained to us the problems that we were in and what the remedies were. And the reason we weren't able to stop this series, which we did last year, remember, was on the word sacrifice. Right? We covered one of the words that's, again, foreign to us in the 20th century Western world generally. The fact that that wasn't the only way he described the cross, but there are 20 others, indicate that there are other areas of challenge for us, other problems that we face. If you remember the way we dealt with sacrifice, we talked about sacrifice, that the whole point of sacrifice was to repair and strengthen healthy relationships. So we had relationships with God and relationships with community members, other people. And if I those were supposed to be good relationships, and if I did something wrong to you, sacrifice and offering was required for us to patch it up. It was still at base a good relationship. We weren't enemies, okay? And so this was just, you know, something we would go through to rekindle our relationship and get back to where we belong, you know, short accounts. Same thing with God. If I violated the covenant and I did not honor him, I would do the same thing because he was the founding member of the community. He was right there with us in our midst, very much a community member. And we would strengthen those relationships by celebration. We would take time off and party together. We would do this to grow our relationships as well. This second theme that we're on this year, redemption. Redemption has to do with trying to get out of abusive relationships and unhealthy ones. This is where I sold myself as a servant or a slave, or I had to sell my property, or I'm captured by an act of war, and I'm in a situation that's abusive. Okay? We will see next year, the next word will be reconciliation. Reconciliation is when I've had a good relationship turn completely bad. Not just a momentary act, but where I have become enemies with someone that I was originally united with. And God will do all the reconciling. We will see that the various aspects of our life and our relationships with God and with others, he's got a separate, they were all problems. They were all problems. But the solution is so great. The provision is so awesome that we can live in hope. We can live in hope. There's a saying that you learn after a while that God doesn't heal all things. He prioritizes. He picks his battles in your life and goes after those. And the things that that he does are all still based on the stuff that flowed from the side and the hands and the feet some 2,000 years ago from his son. It all starts there. It rippled through history in both directions. We know. We've talked about this before. Okay, it rippled all the way through. But he's trying to get us to understand the aggressiveness of that kindness as we go through these studies. And so the study we're on now is redemption. That's the way we translate that in English. And like I say, we don't use that term a lot in English in the modern world in ways that are biblical. But it basically meant rescue by paying something. It cost you something to rescue. The root there of redeeming was somebody got in trouble or in a situation where they were not supposed to be, and I would go and invest time, effort, risk, money, maybe even myself, okay, my safety, to pluck you out of that situation and put you over into a better place, get you out of that abusive relationship and put you in that place. And what we've been looking at the last couple of weeks is that in any such act, you've got a person that does the redeeming, that does the buying or the rescuing. You've got the redeemee, typically Glenn, in my illustration, the needy redeemee. You've got some authority that's over me. I've sold myself into slavery to a master, or I've been captured by a foreign country and are being oppressed, or something of this type. There's an authority. There is the actual cost. What does it cost the Redeemer to purchase Glenn out of that scenario? Okay. What did it actually cost the Redeemer? Was it money? Was it labor? Was it outrage? Moral outrage? Did they have to stop what they were doing and go to law court, pursue this through? In other words, what did it cost? And what we did last week was we started going through passages and looking at each time the word was used and saying, okay, who was the Redeemer? What was the redeemee? What was the oppression? What was bad about being over there? Right? And what were we redeemed to? I got to go home. I got to be free from taxes. I got to be free from oppression. What was the... So we started looking at the structures. And we are now on page 8 of the syllabus. And we're just going through Old Testament passages to understand. And what we were doing on audience participation, that little one sheet, and obviously it was very mild audience participation. Somebody caught me later and said, oh, I thought we were going to do all this weird stuff. And I said, well, no, this is very low key. Is that we had originally divided the group up into different sections to answer the different questions. But toward the end of last week, if you noticed, everybody was answering everybody else's questions. So we're not even going to have virtual groups today. We're going to just leave it like it is and just shout it out from the floor. And for each one of these passages, what we're going to do is I'm going to take you through, I'm going to read the more extended version of it from the Scripture and explain a little bit of the background, and then I'm going to ask these five questions. From what state was the subject redeemed, and what was bad about the state? Remember, that's me, either in slavery or whatever. How did I get into that state? I sold myself in, or I got captured. Third, from whose authority of domination was it redeemed, either the foreign power or the slave master in Egypt, the Pharaoh, or whoever owned me or owned my property or whatever. And what type of adversary was it? Was I captured and being oppressed? Or was it just a legitimate consequence? In other words, I did something wrong and I should have gotten busted for it. And lo and behold, I'm there. Was it voluntary slavery? I just mismanaged my life so badly that I had to sell myself into that. Or alienation from homeland, my family and people. Then what was invested by the Redeemer? What did it cost? Mention that. What did it cost? That's at number 4. And 5, what was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed for? In other words, if my brother Bill bought me out, what did he do that for? Was he going to put me to work at his house? Was he going to have me remodel his home? Poor choice. But what was he going to do with me? You know, what was the goal of that? Was it my freedom to come home or whatever? So those are the factors, those are the questions I'm going to ask you. And you should notice, since you don't get picked up on the microphone, none of your answers get recorded. So we're okay there, all right? So let's look. We've gotten down to number 5. We're on 5, and 5 on that list under D. So we're on page 8, D, number 5. And David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, sons of Rimmon the Beeroite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress. Okay? Historical background is this is in the conflict between David and Saul. Saul at this point has died. One of his sons, Ish-bosheth, has temporarily been announced as king. These two characters have gone in and killed him, assassinated Saul's son, cut his head off, and then brought it to show David, to show their loyalty to David. Obviously, they had not read the earlier parts of Scripture that said what happened the last time somebody came to David with good news like that. Okay. So David, they come in and says, you know, they, well, I don't want to make up stories about them throwing the head and all this kind of stuff, but you can imagine they used appropriate levels of dramatic flair to get their point about how good they were to David. And David answers them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, and I cut off the rest of this, because it says, if you basically, he says, if you would have known what had happened to the last messenger that came this way, right, you would not have done this. They thought they were bringing good news, and I put them to death. How much more people who have killed an innocent, assassinated an innocent man in his bedroom when he was sleeping, basically, right? Just, I mean, not even a military honorable thing, just a cold-blooded assassination. But the phrase here is David has been, David has been chased by Saul, you know, for a decade or so, you know, I mean, a long time. He's been running from, just living in, you know, hole in the ground, literally, hole in the ground to hole in the ground, hiding in the rocks and the caves and stuff like this. And you can imagine every morning David gets up. He's anointed by God. And everybody knows this, including Saul and Jonathan. Jonathan's already given him his robe and says, you know, when you get to be king, take care of my kids and all this kinds of stuff. And every morning David must get up and says, now, Lord, what is this all about again? What is this all about? Now, why am I here? This is not carpet. This is sand. Why am I here? Right? And but David makes a proclamation right here. He says, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress. So he talks about God is the one who has redeemed him from his distress. So question one is, from what state was the subject redeemed? Distress. Redeemed him from distress. And what was bad about distress? Do we need to go into that? Do we need to discuss? That's a little bit stressful. That's a, they come from the same word, distressed, stress tabs, those kinds of things. Right? And it was a pretty bad, and his kind of distress was, you know, wasn't just a psychological thing, because that was a huge component of it. But he was fleeing for his life on a regular basis. He was always out there. Not to mention he was having to hang out with a tremendous number of unsavory characters that were extremely bloodthirsty all the time. That every chance they got, they said, well, can I kill him now, David? Can I kill him? You don't understand what's going on here, right? And that was the subject, distress. How did David get into that state? Now, how did David get into that distress, being chased around by Saul and persecuted for no good reason? Oops, I slipped. Right. Yeah, he was just there. God chose him. He was a God's person in the right place at the right time. That's right. That's a good way to put it. Right? He was there, and it was just being there. In the world, you will have trouble, Jesus says. In the world, you will have trouble. So if you live on this, in this side of what's called the biosphere, you're going to have trouble. You're going to have trouble. And he was there because God had something he wanted to do with David, and therefore it's even worse. If you're in the center of God's will, sometimes it's even worse. He didn't do a lot of it on his own. There were times that he got in trouble on his own, clearly, right, where this wasn't a matter of he was God's person in the right place. He was God's person in the wrong place, and he got into a different state, but that's a different passage. Three, from whose authority or domination was he redeemed? Who had the authority and was oppressing him? Saul. Absolutely. Saul. Okay? And what type of adversary was that? Oppression? Oppression and capture, basically. He was being oppressed. This was a military, political thing. He was out after David. And the basic reason was jealousy and envy. He knew, and every time he got honest for a few seconds, he said, your rule will be righteous. God will exalt you. I know this, David. Take care of my family. You know, they knew this. He knew this. But did it stop him from acting irrationally? No. Does it ever stop us from acting irrationally? Not necessarily. Right. Okay? So that's the type of adversary. What was invested by the Redeemer? Cost or price? Let's see if there's anything of that in the passage. What did it cost God, in the case of David, to free him from Saul on a regular basis? So ended up costing him Saul's death. Saul's death. Did God like Saul? Absolutely. Absolutely. Did Samuel like Saul? Even though Samuel was this good old Semitic, rip your face off, when he called him up, he says, gosh, what are you doing? You know, leave me alone. God's ripped the kingdom out of your thing. But Samuel was the one that said, God forbid that I would stop praying for you. Can't stop praying for you. Right? See? There's still that heart care there. It's there. It's amazing. It's always there. So there was the death of an anointed person of God. And what was the kingdom like while all this was going on? How much blessing was coming on the Israelites because of this internal fighting? Not a lot. Not a lot. They couldn't get on with the kingdom agenda. See? They couldn't get on with the kingdom agenda. God was not being able, in this situation, to bless the Israelites to the extent of which the original promise was. He just couldn't get there from there. What was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed unto or for? So what ended up happening to David? Became king. He stopped fearing for his life for a while. Right? For a while, until he got himself in trouble. Remember? The next time he starts fleeing for his life is because of Absalom, which is a result of his individual sin with Bathsheba. Right? That's how the kingdom starts getting divided, with the divided mind of David and Saul. And so there's a case where he's used this. He says it's a redemption. It's not that God protected me from all distress. We've got to make this point really clear. God doesn't protect us from all distress, right? He redeems us, right? And sometimes the redemption takes different forms. It doesn't look quite as spectacular as crossing the Red Sea. Sometimes it's a matter of Job being able to hold on to the vestige of your confidence in the good heart of God. And even when that starts to break and you're still there, and you, even though you're counseled to curse God and die, you say, no, I just can't get quite there yet. I don't know what's going on. Don't know why. It looks bad, God. Your PR firm is not doing you a justice here. Right? Your positioning's all wrong. But I can't go all the way and say, he's not good. He's not Yahweh. He's not good. I can't get there. I'm tempted, but can't get there. And sometimes that's what redemption is. It's just there, holding on. I remember mentioning earlier that one of the words for faith in sign language is this. One of the words for faith. Hold on that rope. And the Latin has a word for faith. It's faith. It's the other side. It's reposito, where you just repose. You rest back on the green comfort, easy chair, lazy boy of God. Just rest. Huge difference. So faith shows itself in different ways, in different kind of battles that you have to face, right? Okay, so that's five. Let's go to six. Now six, we get into an interesting thing because we get into Job. Now, if there's ever a case that needed redemption, it's Job. He reminds us of this every couple of verses. Hey, remember God? Remember me? This kind of thing. And the first one is, I've got three sections out of Job, but they're by three different characters. Only one of them is by Job. The other one's by his two other friends. And later he says, yeah, some friends you guys are, right? But the first one is by Eliphaz. And I'm going to read a little extended version of it. Blessed is the man whom God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. Now remember, they've got this Coke machine theology, what I call Coke machine theology. You put 55 cents in, you get a Coke in. You put good works in, you get God's blessing out. You obey the law, you get blessing. It's just like a machine. If you put 55 cents in that thing and you don't get a Coke out, it's not the machine's fault. It's your fault. The 55 cents were bogus. They were slugs. or something of this type. You've done something wrong, and you're being punished. And so, by definition, if Job is being busted, you know, and going through this, it's Job's fault. There are no other factors in their worldview other than God and Job. Right? There are no intermediate things that are out there, sons of God, angels and malignant intelligences. These don't show up in that current ancient Near Eastern thought pattern of these people. Okay, in most ancient Near Eastern cultures, they were all over the place. Lots and lots of demons and all these maleficent intelligences and things of this type. But from this standpoint, they were working on the basis of good produces good. And so he says, do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, assuming that Job is being disciplined. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. From six calamities he will rescue you. In seven, no harm will befall you. In famine he will ransom you from death. And in battle from the stroke of the sword. Now, you don't have for all of 19, but 19 says, from six calamities he will rescue you, which means you get either in there or you are protected from it, the threat of it. No harm will befall you. That means the consequences don't fall on you. In famine, he will ransom you from death. All right. Now, ransom means that's a clear price word. That's where you got to pay something. Okay. And he's going to ransom you from death. In other words, normally when a famine occurred, people died. There's lots of death associated with famines, both either from the famine or from the disease that came afterwards, the disease and deprivation that came afterwards. And in battle, he will redeem you, implied from the, ransom you, from the stroke of the sword. All right? So let's look at that structure. From what state, in the case of the famine, from what state was the subject redeemed? Right. Hunger, famine, death by famine. Right? Death from starvation. Right? And what was bad about that state? We just leave it at that. Right? It reduced trade surpluses. No, it actually was dangerous. How would you have gotten into that situation in a famine? How would you get there? You were there. Sometimes the famines were a result of judgment, you know, because God said in Deuteronomy that, you know, if you get way off here, Israel, if you start abusing one another, and you start sacrificing your children in the fire, and you start acting like these, the nations around you, with all the abuse that they do in the name of God, okay, then I'm going to kick you off the land too. But before I do, I will issue notices and warnings, one of which will be famine. And the famine should wake you up, and if that doesn't, I'll send some lions, and if that doesn't, we'll just speak a little louder each time until maybe you get it. Maybe you get it. Okay? So, again, this but often it was just a matter of me being there. Again, just being there. You notice a pattern here about how you get into some of these? Sometimes it's just being there. It's just being there. Right. Okay? From whose authority or domination were they redeemed? Famine. In this particular case, famine is the person that's going to kill them, or the stroke of the sword would have been the enemy, invaders from another country, whatever. Right? So famine or deprivation or an imbalance in nature. The type of adversary would be a consequence engine in this case, because it's just famine produces death in this particular case. What was invested by the Redeemer? So how does God, from Eliphaz's position, would God ransom somebody from death from famine? If they were pleased with God, how would they ransom? Providing some kind of miraculous food, some cases asking them to move. Okay, move. Later, God redeemed, ransomed some of the Jerusalemites by having them from Babylon, by having them surrender, go outside the walls and surrender to Babylon. Right? In the case, the most notable example we've got of this is Elijah. Right, when there's a famine, Elijah goes to the northern kingdom and says, no water, no rain, drought, famine for 3 years, except by my word. In other words, the buck stops here, if you want water, you got to come deal with me. And I, by the way, am a prophet of Yahweh. So be prepared to deal with Yahweh. Right? Nope, 3 years. Right? So he goes off, and God immediately sends him over to this river, this little brook thing, and commands the ravens to drop food on him. Right? Right in the middle, famine's going on in the land. What's interesting is that the next story after that is where he miraculously saves the lives of a widow and her family. God looks, you know, he's always breaking his own rules at some level. I mean, he's always sets these things up, but all the way through, it just blows you away the amount of grace that just, he's a soft heart. He has a soft heart. And this stuff, immediately you have the story of the widow. And, but survived in famine. It was a miraculous intervention. It's sort of weird. You can imagine, you know, I've never seen people do bird washing for a living. You know, but I can imagine Elijah every morning getting up, looking out for the ravens, okay? Who's bringing in the bagel this time, you know? How's this going to happen, you know? There's two of them carrying on the wingspan of a... Well, never mind. We won't go on. Wingspan of a European raven, whatever. Okay, so... And the resulting state in the case of... was just deliverance, right? Now, when you get delivered from famine, when something happens, what is a byproduct of it? When God delivers you in famine, what also comes out of your mouth? Thanks. Absolutely. And thanks is probably, well, I won't say probably, but it is up there with the most healthy things you can possibly do, scripturally. I mean, every problem starts somewhere with a, you know, when they did not give thanks and didn't want to know God, Romans 1. It starts somewhere there, where you sit there and you don't look at the 99 things that are going right, that God has blessed you with, and you're complaining and whining about the one. You sit there and say, oh, God, I'm just going to get it. As we would say where I grew up, just mealy mouth. You know, Bob and Wendy Weiner, you know, kind of thing, right? And And thanks is supposed to be one of the benefits out of it, because thanks opens up a tremendous amount of relationship building with God and with other people. Same thing with other people. Okay, let's look at the next one. Next one is Job. Okay, now Job 6. Is this number 7? Yeah, okay. 7, you're right. We're on 7. And, okay, so... Right, okay, now this is interesting because you may be misled by the little note here. But the text is Job is now confronting his would-be friends. He called his counselors over to sit in silence with him, and they sat in silence just so long before they had to inflict their advice on their good friend Job. They're going to talk him out of this misery and presumably all the psychosomatic problems of the boils and all the other things that are around him, right? And so they're telling him, oh, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. You're doing something wrong. You put the 55 cents in wrong. The quarter was supposed to be turned around this way. You foul something up, Job. Right? And so he says, now you too, Job talking to his friends, you too have proved to be of no help. Okay? You see something dreadful, and you're afraid. In other words, you see something you don't understand here that's bigger than you, like why I'm a righteous sufferer. Here, and this ain't working. Well, all of a sudden my religion's not paying off. Right? It's been really good up to now, but all of a sudden, wham, the bottom has fallen out and we're in something dreadful, and guess what? You're afraid because your slogans don't work anymore. Right? Your little pat answers just don't work. Right? You're afraid. Have I ever said to you, give something on my behalf, pay a ransom from me from your wealth? Deliver me from the hand of the enemy. Ransom me from the clutches of the ruthless. So this is not addressed to God. He's saying to his friends, he said, we're in real stuff here. We're beyond words here. See, your slippery tongue's not going to help here. Have I ever asked you to go the extra mile for me and give something on my behalf? Have I asked you to pay a ransom for me? Have I ever been in this situation? Have I ever asked you to deliver me from the hand of the enemy or to ransom me from the clutches of the ruthless? So this is not an actual case of this, But okay, I switched translations on here. But the tyrants are ruthless. So if tyrants are ruthless tyrants, we're going to use the redeem me from the hand of tyrants. So using that phrase, from what state would a subject be redeemed? Persecution, oppression, maybe thrown in jail, maybe their land confiscated, some kind of situation like that. How would that particular citizen get into that state? A couple of different ways. If it was a foreign tyrant, how would it occur? War, being captured, things of this type. If I was just a citizen and a ruthless tyrant came to power in the state, I might get into that state by just being good or just being on the wrong, on a bad hair day of this person and just be standing there. I might get caught in a long crossfire. I might be slandered by someone else that wants to look good to the king at my expense. See, any number of ways I could get into that. From whose authority or domination would that person be redeemed? From the tyrant. Now, one of the sociological definitions of government, by the way, or anthropologically, is that the government is defined as the only group within the society or the culture that has legitimate rights to violence. And that's one of the sociological definitions of government, is that body, that group, whether it's formal or informal, that the culture says has the right to violence. And in the case of a tyrant, the tyrant makes their own vote. They take a vote. There's one vote. The tyrant says, all in favor of persecuting X, raise your hand. And then one hand goes up. As long as they're not schizophrenic and does this, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And so the tyrant would be this. The type of adversary would be fairly obvious. It'd be oppression and maybe capture. To redeem somebody from the hand of a tyrant. Now let's talk about this for a second. Let's say I'm a tyrant, and I capture you and haul you off to another country, right? You're in exile, and you're my servant, okay? And you're not a favored servant because you're a spoil of war. And then I'm billed back over here, and I'm going to go redeem you from the tyrant. I got two options, right? I can go approach peacefully with money and see if I could buy you, right? Very commonly done in the ancient world. It's a source of revenue, big source of revenue for foreign governments. Is the ransom of nobles and powers and things of this type, especially soldiers, ones that they didn't kill. So I could try the peaceful route. If that didn't work, what would I be forced to do?
Muster an army.
Muster an army. I'd have to do an Abraham go rescuing Lot thing. I'd have to raise up an army, stop what we were doing, do the weapons thing, try to train, you know, whatever, and go launch at great personal risk and tribal risk to our families to recover you. And so my redemption would either try to be a money thing or a huge personal safety risk. Huge personal safety risk. And so in the case of a tyrant, it could be either one of those. And the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed for, what would that be in the case of somebody that was redeemed from a tyrant? In the case of a capture, where would I end up? Well, that's where I ended up to begin with. I was in jail. Hopefully they wouldn't haul me back to my homeland and throw me in jail there. That's an extreme form of extradition, which we're not talking about under redemption. Right. Redemption, if they bought me as a war captive and took me home, freedom. I got freedom. I may be a hero for all I know. Right. But it's a better place than the dungeon over here. Right. In the case of I'm just caught in the crossfire politically and the tyrant throws me in jail, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time, I am Joseph in the dungeons of Egypt. Right? Being in the wrong place at the wrong time, personal integrity or whatever. When I get sprung from jail there, what happens? I may go to a position of authority within the... If I'm vindicated as being righteous or whatever by that pharaoh or that king, I might get put in a place of responsibility. Shoot, my income may quadruple from being in the dungeon. Let's go from zero to four. Right? And in that kind of scenario, redemption, again, is this huge shift from where I was, out of an abusive relationship, into a good place. Let's try to do another one, maybe a couple here. Another one from Job, and this is Elihu. That's the southern pronunciation of Elihu. Okay. For those of you who don't recognize this speech impediment that I have, Dallas, it's got 12 A's in it. Dallas. So Elihu is the young man here. Young man, he went there with these the elders, and he's listening to the wisdom of the elders, and they're not winning the argument with Job. Job is still confounding them. Job will not give up his personal integrity. He says, no, something else is involved. This doesn't make any sense. In other words, Job had the temptation to either say, to try a ritual, well, you know, if I confess sins, God cleans it all away, so I'll just, in case I did something wrong, I'll just short-circuit the system. And I'll lie about my integrity, is what I'll do. I'll be dishonest to short-circuit the system, invoke the rituals, and then I'm off the hook. So I'll be dishonest about what righteousness is and what's right, etc. Or my other alternative is accuse God of wrongdoing. I'm righteous, but all of a sudden, for the first time in the history of the world, God isn't. And maybe he'll go back to being righteous once we clear this up. But right now, he's not doing what he's supposed to do. Okay, he's caught there between those two. Doesn't know what to do. And yet, because of his faith and his knowledge of the character of God, he won't make that choice. He says it can't be that simple. I mean, just can't, something's missing here. How many times have you been there? You know, caught between, you know, what is this all about, God? What is going on here? This doesn't make any sense, etc. Right? And he won't go there. And so his response, they try to talk him into one of those two options, generally this one, confess that you're a sinner, Job, because everybody's a sinner, blah, 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 blah. You know, they went down the standard theological slogan path. And it was a matter of just honesty. He couldn't go there. And so finally the young man, Elihu, says, I have listened long enough to this stuff. He said, I thought I would get all this wisdom from these, you know, gray hair, hoary head types, you know, according to the stuff. And look, nothing wins. Nobody has put Job down. So I'm going to take my crack at it. Right? And so he starts, and he got his long, long section. And the section I'm going to read from here starts back in 23. Job 33, verse 23 and follow. Yet if there is an angel on his side, here's this person having problems. Yet if there is an angel on his side as a mediator, one out of a thousand, a quality individual, to tell a man what is right for him, to be gracious to him and to say, spare him from going down to the pit, I have found a ransom for him. Okay, now what we've got so far is we've got this angelic mediator that's standing by somebody that's about to die, that's in his trouble, and this mediator somehow between him and God said, spare his life, I have found a ransom. I have found a substitute. I have found something to switch these things around. Okay, and that was very common, sympathetic magic and types of magic and healing and things of this type. In the ancient Near East, they would make little figurines of the sick person, very commonly. And they would put the little figurine in the bed with me at night. And under cover of darkness, okay, they would switch us out, and then they would think that the evil spirits would attack, the disease would shift from me to, because they couldn't tell the difference in the dark, it would shift over to the little figurine, and then they'd take the figurine out and bury it, see, and they had faked it out, right? And that's the way they approached types of healings in the ancient Near East. There was a substitute like that, right? But here's an angel says, don't let him die, I have found a complete substitute, it's a ransom. I'm going to buy it out. If that is the case, verse 25, then his flesh is renewed like a child's. This is physical healing. It is restored as in the days of his youth. He prays to God and finds favor with him. The relationship is now repaired. He sees God's face and shouts for joy. He's experiencing God's presence and God's love. He is restored by God to his righteous state. Now he's free again to do right things, to do acts of goodness, acts of mercy. Whereas on his sick bed, he can't even help the poor. He can't even help himself. He cannot deliver God's mercy to those that need it. Then he comes to men and says, I sinned and perverted what is right, but I did not get what I deserve. So he's still trying to talk Job into saying, I sinned, and I should have gotten worse than what I got. He redeemed my soul from going down to the pit, and I will live to enjoy the light. All right, so you've got this deep physical affliction on this individual. There's going to be somebody to ransom them out. Their flesh is going to be renewed like a newborn, and then they're going to get up and live the beautiful life again, the wonderful righteous life. So from what state would the subject be redeemed there? It's sickness going all the way to what? Death, right? Because it's got the grave in here and some strong words like that, but it's just this total death feeding on the model. How did they get into the sickness state? Yeah, now that's there are two aspects. One is this one, that you were in, again, the right place at the right time, right? Because Job, that's where Job was, right? Job was getting bragged on by God up in heaven, right? Up in those opening scenes, it sets this thing up where Job brags on. He says, have you seen anybody like this? You see anybody like this? Because angels sit there watching the stuff down here. See, they watch these little pots of clay and these little mud balls with hair and teeth. And they watch us love. They watch those moments when we greet one another and when we hurt for somebody. Those little flashes of incandescence that come out of these things that we are. And the angels sit there and say, whoa, I've seen that somewhere before. But I think it was on a throne somewhere. See, that there's something there that they don't get it, how this works. You know, this something funny about this. But just these little pockets, these outbreakings of love and care that we have for one another are so, God brags on those. He said, have you seen this? Look at this. Look at this guy. He prays for his kids that I will forgive their sin every morning. Not that God will judge them. Send them to their room, whatever. You know, he says that God will forgive them, break into their life, lead them to the knowledge and serve. You know, look at this. See, look at this. It's got no overpowering, magnificent glory like all you angels have. Right? This is done with a thin thread of awareness of God's presence. But I've let them see my heart. I've let them see my heart. And Job gets caught in one of those. And so Job is in this scenario where God's bragging on him. He's in the right place. Now, in Elihu's, it's just somebody that had actually sinned and got into that place. So that was a little different. But Job was there by being good. By being good. I got to close with this illustration because I'm over here. I remember them telling us a long time ago that, you know, when it talks about Jesus as God as the refiner's fire, you know, I remember somebody telling me about metallurgy and this kind of stuff. They were talking about when you're trying to get impurities out of a metal, at a certain temperature, the easy ones come out. But to get the harder ones out, you got to crank up the temperature a little to get that next layer of impurities out, and it has to keep going to get it all really pure. You know? And for a Job, sometimes you have to go through that and steady through that, and we're all in there somewhere. These kinds of things, and you come up, but there's always, you have to go back under for little pockets. These are training exercises. This is not where life is lived in a total experience. It's much more bland to teach us about other things. We'll get into that some other day, about why life is not the swings of this numinous and just the, you know, most life is in here in the middle for reasons of choice and the way we do things. But in this redemption, what we've seen so far in just a couple of sections we looked at is there's this active snatching out, pulling out. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about the heart of God is out rescuing. He pictures himself consistently as a shepherd going out there and rescuing sheep from bears and lions and redeeming his beloved people from oppression. From themselves. We'll see that in the next couple of verses when we get back together in 2 weeks. But this heart that is in pursuit of us, that went all the way somehow to the cross,
to do this, to get this, and tries to get this across to us, that it's imminently approachable for help. Imminently approachable. It's not cold, not distant, and he's not somebody that has to be redeemed from. It's like most of the answers we learn. Most of the answers and substitutes for God that we approach for help end up being oppressors, addictives, and things of this type. And so God says, there's no strings, it's free, and it's beautiful. But you just got to understand, I'm good-hearted. Good-hearted, come free. Let's close in a word of prayer. Going way over. Father, we thank you for your love, for your kindness, for your inbreaking into our history, not leaving us to our own ignorance to try to figure this stuff out. Thank you for the vivid demonstration of your love, that you are a God with a beating, passionate heart for delight, for kindness, for affirmation, for drawing us to yourself. And we would just pray that we would understand that more this week, appreciate that more this week, and turn to you more this week as we try to make progress on our journey, on our journey to you and with you in this life, that we might walk freely before you and humbly, that we might live out your character this week. Bring us back safely together in the future, and honor your Son in our lives and through our lives this week. Amen. Okay. That.